Alrighty, have you all been blessed this week? I don't know about you, but some of these topics that I've honestly grown up hearing, just hearing them in a new perspective, a different set of point of view, I have been truly blessed. And this morning, I want to share just one more topic with you. Bow your heads with me. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for this privilege that we can come together and worship you in this fashion. I pray that you'll be with us as we conclude our week of spiritual emphasis and help at least one of us to leave here with a blessing today. In your name I pray, amen. According to fairof.net, on the top 100 phobia list, and phobia by way of definition is an intense, irrational fear. Arachnophobia, which is the fear of spiders, ranked number one. And number two, I can personally relate to, ophidiophobia, which is the fear of snakes. Number three, the fear of heights. Number four, agoraphobia, the fear of tight, crowded spaces, kind of your claustrophobia, and so on and so forth. But I want to take a look at number 31, theophobia, the fear of God, which causes an irrational fear, intense fear of God or religion. In fact, 57% of Americans fear the wrath of God more than the wrath of anyone else, including that of their spouse. Most of us have a background of Christianity. We attend Highland Academy. We've at least attended church. But maybe there's a possibility that we're just not sure we're going to make it. We may have been baptized and committed our lives to Christ, or we may be on the other end of the spectrum and not want anything to do with God, and as soon as you leave these doors, walk out of Highland Academy, you may never attend church again, or we may be riding this happy medium of nonchalance, going to church on Saturday morning because that's what you do before haystacks and Snapchats and Clue clothes, but as soon as the sun sets for the next 6 days, not really caring. And honestly, if that's not good enough to get me to heaven when Jesus comes back, what next? We live in a society that has promoted the concept of a vengeful God, especially the generation prior to us. They've developed this view of a God whose wrath zaps the wicked, subjecting them to eternal torment in his consuming fire. Sister White says, "It is beyond the power of the human mind to estimate the evil which has been wrought by the heresy of eternal torment." The religion of the Bible, full of love and goodness and abounding in compassion, is darkened by superstition and clothed with terror. Theophobia, the fear of God. When we look at Hollywood, the media, and honestly, even what is sometimes preached from the pulpit, it's not hard to wonder why our God of love is feared and even hated. Where did this idea of eternal torment come from? Satan himself, the master deceiver, originated the doctrine of eternal torment. He knew that fear of punishment and misunderstanding of God's character and justice would eventually warp human reasoning. This is utter injustice to God's character. It presents him as the tyrant of the universe. Over and over again, we've heard that God is a God of love. So the question arises, how could a God of love do this? Or have we just developed an unfair view of our Creator? Death itself has been distorted from going straight to heaven to burning forever in hell to a plethora of ideas in between like reincarnation and purgatory. Now, the Bible clearly states that the dead know nothing. But when God returns and the dead are raised, God will reveal his glory and the fire of his presence will wash over both the wicked and the righteous. Hebrews 12:19 says, "Our God is a consuming fire." Isaiah 33:14 adds, "The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has seized hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? He who walks righteously and speaks uprightly, he who despises the gain of oppressions, who gestures with his hands, refusing bribes, who stops his ears from hearing of bloodshed and shuts his eyes from seeing evil." I want to touch on this fire for a little bit because this was interesting to me when I was preparing this. I sought out some other resources and I just kept hearing this fire, this consuming fire. And honestly, I've never thought of it. I've never understood it. But it's this fire that comes when Jesus returns. Those who love God are renewed by his glory. But those who deny Christ die by a literal cleansing fire. It's not metaphorical. It's a literal fire. But it's the same presence that Peter, James, and John beheld on the Mount of Transfiguration. It's the same presence in which Moses, we remember that story, and all the elders of Israel beheld in Exodus. And it's the same fiery presence in which Satan himself, before his fall, walked among in heaven, the same fiery presence. It has not changed. But this same fiery presence will cleanse all nature that has been polluted and deformed by sin, and the earth will be made new. The righteous will be untouched because for them, this fiery presence is a sun and shield, but the wicked cannot stand in God's presence and live. By a life of rebellion, Satan and all who unite with him place themselves so out of harmony with God that to them his very presence is a consuming fire. The glory of him who is love will destroy them. Darkness hides from light. Evil cannot coexist. Evil cannot abide with righteousness. God does not make compromises with sin. Disobedience has consequences. For the last several years, I have been babysitting. And for several families in my area, there's this one family that has four boys who are now about between the ages of 2 and 12. On one particular occasion, I was just starting dinner. I set a pot of water on the stove to make some mac and cheese. And the four-year-old, who is the second from the youngest, middle children, I'm the youngest. Anyway, he's my challenge. I love him to death. He's hilarious, rambunctious, tons of energy. But he's always trying to test my limits, you know? Like, how far can I go to make Natalie's day, you know? Okay. But anyway, so he loves helping me cook. We usually make cookies together. You know, I like to cook. It works out great. But this particular occasion, the family had just bought a new stove. Sleek, flat-top stove, you know. And it had these tantalizing red rings when it was on that were a little wider in circumference than the pot. So when I set this water on, he's sort of like hovering over it. He's on this little stool. And I'm just like, dude, it's just water. I haven't even put the pasta in yet. But he's like hovering over it. And I told him, you know, I need you to back down. I don't want you to accidentally fall and burn yourself. But he's just like, no, I'm fine. You know, I'm big. I'm four. I can do this. And I'm just like, no, I was insistent. I need you. I have other stuff to do. I'm not just going to stand here and watch you watch this water start to boil. So he kind of does like the eye roll thing. Like, I was coming down anyway. You know, I don't need you to tell me that. And ambles over to this other counter. So I go to turn my body to the cover to get the macaroni. And I'm looking for macaroni. I turn around, and you have to use your imagination. We have a stove, and the counter, and then the refrigerator, which kind of protrudes from the counter. So you have this nice little corner. And there, let's call him Matt, okay? So there's Matt wedged in between the counter and the refrigerator. You picture with me? He's kind of wedged in, and he has his arms crossed like this, and his right hand is in a fist, like curled in a fist. And he has this tight, his jaw is set in this tight line, okay? And he's not saying anything. He's just there kind of like this. And I'm just like, oh, great. Matt, did you burn yourself? You know, I'm thinking, I kind of need this job. I'm saving for a car. I don't want to go to the emergency room. Like, did you burn yourself? He's like, no, I'm fine. I'm like, okay, good. But I look at him again, and his jaw is in this tight line, and his hand is still in this fist. I'm just like, I've been burnt before, and I know those first couple seconds, those first minutes are horrendous. So I turn off the pot, and I kneel down beside him, and I say, Matt, you're not going to get in trouble. I just need you to tell me, did you burn yourself? And I'll put some medicine on it, and it'll make it all better. Immediately, the tears start flowing, and he uncurls his hand. There's this huge blister on the side of his hand, and ready forming and welting. So put some medicine on it. It makes it feel all better. Could I have forced him not to touch the stove? I could have threatened him with beatings. I could have hovered over him and slapped his hand as it touched the stove. I could have never let him cook with me, all of which would never actually stop him from wanting to try to touch the stove. Would that ever make him trust me or know that it hurt me to see him hurt? To realize that I was only seeking his best interest? How much so, God? We need to establish that he will never force us, never force us to love him, never force us to trust him, to choose him, or serve him. Love and force are mutually exclusive. Light and darkness cannot coexist. In fact, force disables the ability to love. And being a God of love, he'll never force our submission. Matt would never love or trust me if I achieved his obedience by force or threats. When we choose a way other than God's way, we're essentially telling God to leave us alone. And he's going to respect that choice. The death of unbelievers is not an arbitrary act on the part of God. I know Caleb touched on sin and how it's separation from God. How true, when we choose a life of sin, we cut ourselves off from life. But God cries over those he has to give up. Hosea 11:8 says, "Oh, how can I give you up, Israel? How can I let you go?" But God must vindicate his law and deliver his people. The wages of sin is death. Instant, eternal death should have taken Adam and Eve right there in the garden. But God stepped in to give humanity a second chance to choose between eternal life and eternal death. Isaiah 53:6 says, "The iniquity of us all was laid on Christ." The cross confirms that it's sin that kills. God's glory is his character. And if we don't have a desire for the glory of God, the good, the components of his character, it naturally follows that we cannot live. So ultimately, we decide our eternal destiny by who we trust and who in turn we choose to become like. If over and over we reject Christ, the great controversy says God withdraws his spirit and leaves them to the deceptions which they love. The wicked condemn and destroy themselves. Freedom is the only way a God of love can be a God of love. Christ doesn't want service out of fear. He wants the only motivation to be love. The creator of the universe wants to be my friend. God knows that when we withdraw from him, there's only suffering and ultimately death, and we need to know that too. There's someone who has studied this much, much more than you and I have, and he's just waiting for the opportunity to seize this up, to distort your so image, to distort your image of God and your conception of the truth. There's a story circulating on the internet, and you might have heard it, but if you have, it's worth repeating, and you will grin and bear it. But I love this story. There once was a woman who had a pet snake, and this picture is repulsive to me. I can't even look at it, Anyway. She had a pet snake. She loved snakes. She did not have the fear of snakes. And the snake was about 7 feet long. Seven feet long. And one day, it just stopped eating. She did everything. She gave it its favorite foods. She tried everything. And after several weeks of doing this, and it still wasn't eating, she was getting worried because it was getting sick. And so, like every good snake owner, she takes it to the vet and explained her situation to the vet. And the vet asks her some questions. So just he's like, "Okay, I want to know about your general habits. Does your snake usually sleep with you?" She's like, "Yeah, it's my pet. Of course he sleeps with me." And then she's like, "Okay, well, more recently, has he been snuggling really close, trying to get up close to you?" Yes. She's like, "Wow, is this kind of psychic?" "Yes, actually he has. Has he been stretching out, looking kind of uncomfortably stretching out?" She says, "Yes, oh my word, and it makes me so sad because I just don't like to see him in pain." Okay. The woman replies, "This is actually a true story. Yes, he's been doing this every day." The vet says, "Ma'am, your snake's not sick. The problem is with you. The snake is preparing to eat you. He has been sizing you up every day, so he knows just how big he has to be. He has not been eating. He has been starving himself to make space, to make sure he has enough room to digest you. He is preparing to eat you. The devil has sized you and I up. He is trying to distract us. He knows our weaknesses. He has used every medium that he possibly can to so distort our image, our conception of truth, our conception of God's image. He has used entertainment, intellectual sources, false theologies. He has used fear to turn a God of love into a God of tyranny. If we allow the devil to infiltrate our lives, sin will devour us. It will consume us. And this theophobia, this fear of God, this should not exist in the Christian life. This fear causes us to have misconceptions of a loving God. What is your image of God? My challenge for you is to search God's character for yourself. How do you perceive God's love? A God who has sacrificed his only son so that you and I could be saved? A God of second chances? An older gentleman was listening to the young man excitedly relaying his accomplishments through high school and his dreams for attending college. He mentioned being captain of the football team, honor roll, most likely to succeed. And he obviously was very goal-orientated and enthusiastic about his future. So the older gentleman was listening and nodding, and then said, "And then what next?" The young man blurted without hesitation that once he gets his bachelor's degree, he's going to pursue his master's, get his doctorate. The older gentleman replied, "What next?" The young man thought for a moment and said he wanted to work for a major corporation and make lots of money. The older man said, "Great. What next?" "A probably fine, gorgeous lady. We'll get married, live in a nice house, I'm thinking Colorado, lots of mountains, have about 3 kids." With sincere interest, the older man said, "What next?" The young man was kind of becoming a little frustrated by now, but answered, "I'll probably retire, golf capital of the world, enjoy my grandkids. By then, I'll deserve it. You know, I've certainly done enough for society." The older man replied, "What next?" The young man thought for a second about this one, and then he's like, "You know, I will probably die." The older man, without blinking an eye, questioned, "What next?" Shuddering at this question, the young man, so quick to respond before, did not have an answer. This is the question I'm asking you this morning. What next? What next, freshmen? What next, sophomore, junior, seniors, to the faculty and staff? What next? You may have a fear of God, or the thought may never have crossed your mind, but I want you to walk out of here with a question on your mind. What am I doing today to choose life? Our theme text for the year, Deuteronomy 30:19, we all should be knowing this by now. Today, I have given you the choice between life and death, between blessings and cursings. Now I call on heaven and earth to witness the choice you make. Oh, that you would choose life, that you and your descendants might live. The choice is yours. What next?